Derby tea pack. That's basically it. Some packs is good, but like an English pack. Okay, excellent. With all that fun stuff, let's talk a little bit about the format. You probably know it all by now. We have three speakers on each side. Speeches will be 10 minutes long. The middle 8 minutes will be unprotected time, so you can stand up, say a point of information. Obviously, they don't like to take that point. And please try and keep these brief, 15 seconds tops, just because otherwise it really gets into the speeches too much. We'll also be having round of four speeches. So after the second speech, we'll have two in proposition, two in opposition, two in abstention. I still don't quite know what abstention means. But if you know what it does, then try and work that out if you can. Sort of, if you don't agree or disagree, you just sort of, you know, you want to say where you think it's eventually going, do that. And we'll be doing another round of those after the fourth speech as well. Obviously, this is all I want to do is significant. We'll be voting the way in, we'll be voting the way out. And we'll announce the results in the bar and also the switch. Excellent. So with all that said, let's get the debate underway. Our first speaker of proposition is Francis Scott.
Okay. I'm not sticking to English conservatism, but a bit of Scottish passion, if you don't mind. Ladies and gentlemen, I put it to you that the rise of so-called Islamic extremism, as we know it today, is a direct result of the negligence and hypocrisy that has characterised Western foreign policy over the last 25 years. Since the end of the Cold War, the West has created an enabling environment for the growth of extremism in parts of the predominantly Muslim world. Obviously, it's fair to say that the history of Western intervention in these areas goes back hundreds of years, and in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan has been repeated many, many times with increasingly tragic results. But I'd like to look at the last 25 years. I'd like to put it to you that the free hand given to the CIA, combined with a failure to consider the implications of key decisions, plus the total failure to take into account the needs of suffering populations in the Middle East, has led to the situation today where extremists acting in the name of religion have relative freedom to operate in Somalia, Yemen, parts of Nigeria, parts of Sudan, parts of Pakistan and Afghanistan, and of course in Iraq, Syria and Libya. Western foreign policy has propped up failing dictatorships that have deprived their populations of dignity and hope. Western foreign policy has led to unwelcome and unrequested invasions in Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. These invasions, according to their own self-justifying criteria of establishing democratic functioning states, have been failures. Western governments have failed to support or abide by the universal human rights standards that they publicly promote. They've turned a blind eye when it suits them to actions that have fed grievances and actions that have directly promoted extremism. For example, the reality of prisons in Egypt, which became an important conduit for extremist thought. Some of you will have heard of the notion of blowback, which is defined in the dictionary as the unintended consequences of a covert operation. The term is most frequently applied to the effects of the US support for the Mujahideen fighting the Soviet regime in Afghanistan. The consequences have been wider than those first commentaries dared to imagine. Afghanistan, though, is only one part of this jigsaw. There are a number of events that occurred around the time of the fall of the Soviet Union that I believe have led to where we are today. So in building this picture of negligence and failure, I'd like to remind you of a few key moments. The US invasion of Iraq supposedly liberated Kuwait and Iraq in February 1991. But by March 1991, they failed to support the Shia uprisings in southern Iraq, right, resulting in widespread bloodshed and long-term resentment. In April 1992, the communist-backed regime fell in Afghanistan, but the West magically stopped intervening. In December 1992, the US led an invasion of Somalia called Operation Restore Hope that destroyed hope and ended in March 1994 with the departure of US troops and no order in Somalia. In May 1994, there was civil war in Yemen. All of these events and Western reaction to them helped directly fuel the rise of extremism since. The poor decisions in Afghanistan and Iraq led directly to the repeat invasions in 2001 and 2003. In the case of Iraq, of course, this was not just poor decision-making, it was perverse. President Bush personally encouraged the Iraqi population to rise up to overthrow Saddam Hussein in March 1991. By the end of April, that is only 1 month later, he was publicly denying that he had ever done so. Having supported Saddam's brutal consolidation of power in the 1990s, the US then went on to compound their errors in 2003 by disbanding the only functioning national institutions in Iraq, the Ba'ath Party and the Iraqi army, and sowing the seeds of distrust amongst the Sunni population, all of which led to the catastrophe of today with rampant extremism across the country. I'd put it to you that it didn't have to be that way. If you look at the relative stability of Iraqi Kurdistan and the relative lack of sectarian conflict in that part of Iraq, perhaps we can say that that demonstrates what might have happened had the West kept its word in 1991. I included the civil war in Yemen as part of my moments of importance because I think what happened in Yemen graphically illustrates the tragic results of the West's policy of propping up failed dictatorships.
Point of information.
Yes.
You can get that.
Jonathan Hughes, Homerton College. So you've been you've essentially started your speech by listing off lots of interventions which you think have gone badly. I think actually it's much more nuanced than that. You talk about northern Iraq with the Kurdish population being much more stable. Perhaps I'm mistaken, but surely that's because of the no-fly zone the West implemented to stop Saddam gassing the Kurds. But my point goes beyond that, which is there are plenty of oppressed people in the world who have had awful things done to them, but you don't see a similar reaction. For instance, the Buddhist Tibetans have had their country taken over by the Chinese, but where are the Buddhist Tibetan suicide bombers?
I think we're talking about so-called Islamic extremism, which, as far as I'm concerned, is concentrated in different parts of the world, which doesn't include Tibet. And Saddam gassed the Kurds before the West did anything about them, I'm sorry to say. And I think actually that underlines my point, that actually we're supporting Saddam at that point. So my point is it's about Western hypocrisy in our support for regimes and underlining it, not the opposite. As I said, I included the civil war in Yemen because I think it illustrates the problem of propping up failed dictatorships. Ali Abdullah Saleh won the civil war with the help only of the so-called Afghan Arabs, the Yemenis who had been spent time fighting in Afghanistan on the side of the Mujahideen, supported by US money and military hardware. The price of that victory was space to operate and a blind eye to terrorist operations as long as they were carried out somewhere else apart from in Yemen. The Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula is now one of the most professional offshoots of Al-Qaeda. I think that's a very high price to pay for propping up failed dictatorships. Yemen was actually one of the most democratic countries in the Middle East in 2003. But also in 2003, it was helped by another failed experiment of US warfare, which was the use of unmanned drones to target terrorists. There's no rule of law in that, no process to decide who is targeted, no responsibility, no impunity. Many innocent lives have lost. Is it a surprise that this has become a successful recruiting tool for extremists everywhere? You might not have noticed, but last week, Al-Qaeda in the peninsula took over the Yemeni port of Al-Muqallah. Al-Muqallah has been one of the few booming areas of Yemen and the direct outlet for Yemen's oil exports. The space for extremists to operate has just got much bigger. But is the West responsible? I would say yes. The US and other so-called friends of Yemen propped up Ali Abdullah Saleh, as I said, during a period when organised legal opposition was growing. Outwardly, Yemen was one of the most open and democratic societies in the Middle East. But that was lost as a dictator clung to power and the prolonged transition process from 2011 left him free to operate, but arguably also disenfranchised both the young people in the street who had challenged power and the Houthis who felt excluded from the resulting arrangements. This half-baked arrangement was endorsed and promoted by the West and their Gulf allies. Ladies and gentlemen, I put it to you that we must all take responsibility for the space that has been left for terrorism and extremism in a country that was known for its moderate interpretations of Islam. I focused on Yemen because it's a country I know, but even clearer examples of the West's responsibility for creating the opportunity for extremism to flourish exist in Iraq and in Libya. There was no plan for intervention, no understanding of local dynamics, no natural allies on the ground who truly welcomed Western intervention. And in both cases, as in Somalia, an urgency to get out quickly once the going got tough. And the logical results of Western intervention became clear. As the only superpower following the fall of the Soviet Empire, the US took on the mantle of world's policeman. But it was a brutal policeman who dealt violently with those considered to be its enemies. This policeman failed to play by the rules of the global system it should have been defending. In the interests of stability and oil flows, corrupt dictatorships were supported in Egypt, Sudan, Yemen, and throughout the Gulf. Young men and women looking for champions to fight against the daily brutality in which they lived were unlikely to find solace from the United States. As moderate opposition were rounded up and tortured throughout the Arab world and beyond, it's small wonder that extremists operating inside prisons found many potential adherents. Individuals must always be held accountable for their own actions, but ladies and gentlemen, I put it to you that those who create the conditions for terrorism and extremism to flourish must also be held accountable. The House should uphold the motion that the West is responsible for the rise of Islamic extremism. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. And now to open the case for the opposition, we have Ronald Simcox, who is a researcher of the Heterodoxy Society, where he specialises in Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda inspired terrorism, and is a co-author of both editions of Islamist Terrorism, the British Connect. Please, a warm round of applause for Mr. Robinson.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. What a great honour to speak at this university. What a fantastic venue to be speaking at. Thanks for having me, and I'm really honoured to speak on such a vital subject today. The West is not perfect. Who, or indeed what, is? We've made mistakes, of course we have. But the West is not responsible for Islamic extremism. I'm going to describe to you tonight just some of the atrocities perpetrated by Islamist terrorists that have been reported in the last 7 days alone. This is the last week. Think on them and consider whether it is truly our fault that these things have happened. In Libya, at least 30 Ethiopian Christians are beheaded by ISIS. Do you know what ISIS said as justification for this attack? "We swear to Allah, you will not have safety, even in your dreams, until you embrace Islam." That doesn't sound like someone who's willing to stop the bloodshed if America has less troops in Afghanistan. That, to me, sounds like someone saying that attacks will continue until his horrendous version of Islam is dominant. In Cameroon, the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram raided an ordinary village and killed 19. Many of those killed were beheaded. Ladies and gentlemen, tell me, what action by the West could possibly explain why Nigerian terrorists are beheading civilians in Cameroon? In Somalia, Al-Shabaab terrorists bombed a UN vehicle. Yep, you heard that right. Those rapacious imperialists over at the UN. A body that was against the Iraq war, something we hear so often is the key driver behind terrorism. 6 were killed in this attack. An Al-Shabaab spokesman subsequently said that the UN would never have peace, that they will taste our bullets. Do you know who 4 of those killed worked for in that UN attack? UNICEF, the Child Protection Agency. What foreign policy or imperialist crimes did UNICEF commit? Whose oppression was reduced by the killing of UNICEF workers? The next day, Al-Shabaab blew up a restaurant in Mogadishu. Just regular people going about their day. Is that one down to us as well? Or is there something else behind all this? Yesterday, you may have seen the arrest of an Algerian man in Paris who was planning an imminent terrorist attack against churchgoers. So these are people now being targeted for the crime of praying to the wrong god. In Australia, you may have seen ISIS-inspired teenagers arrested for planning an attack against those attending a World War Memorial ceremony. Also arrested in connection to this was a 14-year-old in Blackburn. He probably wasn't even alive during 9/11. He was certainly a toddler during the initial invasion of Iraq. And targeting those commemorating World War I, a war that was over 100 years ago? I mean, what next is this? I mean, are we going to get angry Frenchmen trying to attack the UK because they're still a little sore about how things turned out at Waterloo? Are we going to get disgruntled Russians targeting us because they wish things had, you know, not gone the way they did in Crimea in 1856?
Points of information.
Not right. I'm joking, obviously, but there's a serious point. Even if you do think we have this imperialist warmongering past, at what point does this generation stop suffering because of it? I stress again, all of what I said was in the last week alone. Atrocities in Cameroon, Libya and Somalia, atrocities averted in Australia and France. But let me give some examples even closer to home. There was a terror cell in 2004 that planned to detonate a fertiliser bomb in the UK. The security services monitored their conversations. One of the plotters suggested blowing up a nightclub in London. His reasoning, I quote, "A big nightclub in central London. No one can put their hands up and say they're innocent, those slags dancing around." Ladies and gentlemen, if this is the fault of the West, what is the answer here? Do we shut down every nightclub? What is the answer to those who murdered the employees of Charlie Hebdo magazine in Paris for exercising their freedom of speech? Shut down all satirical magazines? Why not go the whole hog and bring back blasphemy laws? Remember the suicide bombing that took place in Stockholm, December 2010? Who do we blame that one on? The imperialist Swedes and their oh-so-aggressive foreign policy? I don't think so. Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to imagine something. I want you to imagine the 19 hijackers on 9/11. Imagine the level of hatred that would persuade someone to turn a plane into a missile. The hatred of someone who could even dream that up. Those men sat in the departure lounge before getting those fateful flights. They sat among ordinary men, women and children, people of all faiths. This was no war zone. These were ordinary people going about their lives. Civilians, not soldiers. The hijackers looked those people in the eye and they decided, yeah, these people deserve to die, and they deserve to die in their hundreds and thousands. Those deaths were not the fault of you or I or anyone in this room. They were not the fault of any past politician, diplomat, or head of state. They were the fault of the killers and the killers alone. Don't believe that these are helpless men who have no choice, have no agency. We let terrorists off the hook by doing so. We give these killers excuses that they never asked for. By saying that the murderers had no choice but to carry out these acts, you not only do a disservice to the memory of those killed, you discredit all those who see exactly the same perceived injustices across the world and don't believe the best or only reaction is mass murder. We see the same brutality today with ISIS. The British man, Mohammed Emwazi, Jihadi John. Do you really think Emwazi is standing there, knife in hand, next to the neck of Stephen Soltoff or Alan Henning, or the people who've died, conflicted like some modern-day Hamlet? Should I? Shouldn't I? And then he remembers, once the US once had a military base in Saudi Arabia, so of course I've got to chop the head off the nearest journalist or aid worker. Ladies and gentlemen, Islamism is a movement that is driven by ideas. It has its own propulsion. It has an all-encompassing ideology. Extremists such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS want, for example, an Islamic caliphate that would institute Sharia law. That's a non-negotiable for them. And it's not a desire that's going to disappear, depending on our actions. It's also, I should point out, not working out brilliantly well the caliphate that's existing at the moment in parts of Iraq and Syria. But to those of you who are still not convinced, and I'm sure there are many, I would ask you to at least consider the following. Perhaps it's not just foreign policy of the West that people like Al-Qaeda hate. Because in recent months, we've not just seen the beheading of aid workers, the beheading of civilians, the beheading of journalists. We've also seen ISIS push gay men off buildings, men being trapped in cages and burned to death, women being stoned to death, the kidnap and rape of schoolgirls in Iraq and Nigeria. Think of ISIS's recent destruction of ancient artifacts in Mosul and how it mirrored the Taliban destroying statues of Buddha in Afghanistan over a decade earlier. At least consider the notion that this is not all done in response to the West and its foreign policy, but also because of modernity. Separation of religious institution and state, the emancipation of women, freedom of expression, equality under the law, scientific inquiry, man-made law, freedom of religion. Ladies and gentlemen, we cannot compromise these things. They are rights and advances we fought hard for, and they are worth defending, and they are worth defending to the hilt. It's always going to be tempting to think this is our fault. We in the West are prone to introspection, as we should be. We must always aspire to set the highest standards, and we do not, of course, always meet them. When we do not, we should be honest about it. But it's tempting to think this is our fault for another reason. Because if this is all our fault, truly our fault, then we can change our behaviour and the problems go away. It's tempting, but it's wrong. It's leading us into dangerous territory. Because if it's not Afghanistan, it's Iraq. If it's not Iraq, it's Somalia. If it's not Somalia, it's Cameroon. If it's not foreign policy, it's your religion. If it's not your religion, it's nightclubs. If it's not nightclubs, it's cartoons. And if it's not cartoons, I promise you it will be something else. But in one way, yes, I'll concede, I agree with the motion tonight. Yes, we are responsible for Islamic extremism. We all are. We all are in this room. We're responsible for arguing for its downfall. Just like we had a responsibility to face down past totalitarian ideologies, we must now do so again. Ladies and gentlemen, take a small step in that direction tonight. Vote against this motion.
Other people through drone strikes, through terrible acts. That's why we're responsible. It's not because we can be to blame for what they believe in. It's because we've given them a right and a way of believing and expressing that belief.
Jonathan Hughes, Homerton College. So I realised that my previous point about the pudding diabetes didn't go quite down quite as well as I'd imagined. What I essentially meant to say was I concur with Mr. Sincox in what he said, in that these things are caused by ideas. Now, I am absolutely unwaveringly of the opinion that Islam is not a religion of peace. And this is what I mean when I say that you don't find Buddhist Tibetan suicide bombs. Because whereas I think you can make a plausible argument within the Islamic faith, I think you'll have a right of reply afterwards. Whereas you can make a plausible argument within the Islamic faith for vengeance violence. You simply couldn't do that, or at least it would be much harder to do that in Buddhism. I'm speaking, you don't get the opportunity to. Okay, my essential point is this: you can draw straight lines from Islamic beliefs to the actions we're currently seeing in Islamic extremism, and nothing should obfuscate that fact.
Yeah, just a quick point. Well, there actually is violence in Tibet, and the Chinese have actually called the Dalai Lama a chief terrorist, strangely. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't. It's not true. But there is riots and violence and killing of Chinese military forces in Tibet. So there is unrest in Tibet. You're wrong about that.
okay, now we have to set you for the people over here. Did anyone go? No? Okay. Yeah, just the gentleman over there.
I think my point is it's very difficult debate to agree, and to some extent, I want to address this in peculiar cases. I'm from Nigeria, and as you said, she mentioned it, the speaker from the coalition mentioned Nigeria, but none of the examples she mentioned the peculiar case in Nigeria. And I think the mistake we'll all be making here, if we blame the West, we'll fall into the deep seat of generalization of West being the main problem. But I will want to talk also that the extremism in Libya and some other countries in Iraq is probably different from what we have in Nigeria. How do you blame the West about what is going on in Nigeria? The West haven't contributed anything. However, the point here is that there is a problem with extremism in Nigeria, in the fact that it's not about the West, there is poverty. But the main question I want us to address is, why is it that everything about Boko Haram, which is the terrorist group we have in Nigeria, is all about promoting Islam? We also have poverty among Christians in Nigeria, which is also a big religion in that same country. And none of them have ever taken arms against the government and also promote that religion with violence. So I think we also have to address why is that most of this extremism is through religion and all of them say the same language, promote Islam. I don't want to blame Islam as a violent religion because I've had very friendly Muslims. However, I think it would be nice for us to look where is this problem coming from. Is it that the problem is the interpretation of the religion or the means of communicating that religion? Whichever way, I would advise the leaders in Islam to address this problem and find why is that this same language is common.
Point of information.
Like, you can't find the information of all this.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to make a brief point. Over the last year, I've done quite a lot of work with Christian and Muslim religious leaders from Nigeria. And unfortunately, the sad reality is there has been violence from both sides. I would recommend the famous film called The Imam and the Pastor. This is an imam and a pastor who were both involved with violent groups in the past in Nigeria. And the pastor lost his hand through that. And they were both using religion, Islam and Christianity, to promote violence against the other side. Now they've both seen the light in their work towards peace and reconciliation. So it's absolutely not right that Islam is the only religion which is misused for violence and extremism and terrorism. Every single world religion is prone to that, and every single world religion is being used for terrorism. And I'll say more later.
So now we're going to go back to Constantine's proposition. Sorry, there are such key people over there. Just a gentleman, in the white.
Hi, Charles Devendori, Downing College. I'd just like to make the point that places like Saudi Arabia, where there's a monarchy who enforce in really strict laws against women, where women can't drive, and the money that you have is directly related to how close you are to the Sheikh. The West don't do anything there, and I'm not for a minute suggesting that we should go to war in Saudi Arabia. What I'm saying is, to set all the intervention of the West in the Middle East, in countries across the world, have purely, or that's evidence to suggest, at least, that it's to do with self-gain rather than doing what's right, defending the right to free speech, equality, all the rest of it. Thank you.
Which part of the college? Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I was listening to Frances Guy's speaking proposition and I found myself a bit puzzled. She criticises the West for popping up evil dictators and then she criticises the West for intervening. It seems that we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. I would agree that some of the interventions haven't been very successful, but the indigenous problems of these countries are caused in the countries themselves. Evil dictators may be a problem, unsuccessful interventions may be a problem, but who's to guarantee that we can make a successful intervention? Or we leave the dictators where they are. We're not responsible for the impossibility of doing the right thing in an impossible situation.
Mark Proctor, Trinity College. The opening speakers have both focused quite a lot on foreign policy, and just for the forthcoming speakers, I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about the position of Muslims, Muslim populations within Western societies, particularly with reference to the Sharia code. So, point of discussion.
Next up, so now we're going to turn to the main debate. We will, of course, have one more round of apologies if you'd like to say. Okay, now we have Dr. Issa Hussain. Dr. Hussain is a member of the Women's Policy Department and researcher for comparative politics, Islam, and Muslim politics. Her forthcoming book is called The Structure of Islamic Law in Colonial India. Blair is pleased, a huge round of applause for Dr. Issa Hussain.
Thank you. Thank you for asking the question. That's where we're going now. Just a quick thought experiment, a minor alteration to the proposition. Quickly. This House believes the West is responsible for Christian extremism. Is it difficult to imagine us being responsible? Less difficult, I'd imagine. Slightly less difficult. For two reasons, I'd argue. This House would have little difficulty assigning responsibility to the West for Christian extremism because it would hold the West responsible for what is part of itself. Christianity is part of Western society. Christian extremists are part of who we are. Therefore, we cannot say we are not responsible. And the second reason is that Christianity is and has long been indispensable to the West. It is part of what makes the West the West. So what changes when the subject is Islamic extremism? It's easy to begin from the presumption that Islamic extremism is not part of Western society, that Islam is not part of what makes the West the West. But I will argue that it is, and that the West is responsible for Islamic extremism because Islamic extremism is and has for a long time been indispensable to the West. Now, the idea of the West isn't self-evident or natural. It isn't obvious that the English and the Americans, the English and the French and the Germans, the Australians and the Russians should have anything more in common with each other than Iranians and Iraqis, Saudis and Somalis, Pakistanis and Indonesians. It is only juxtaposed against each other that these lists gain their coherence. The idea of the West in international society and international relations requires an outsider to unify and define it. Key Western thinkers, from Montesquieu and Voltaire to Weber and Samuel Huntington, let's not forget, often themselves important agents in projects of European empire building, characterize Islam as the extreme against the West, itself a category in the process of always being made, defined the West as civilized, as secular, as moderate. So the very idea of the West emerges out of imperial context. in Central, West, South, and Southeast Asia. A West that defined itself as the norm and the aspiration first, and then defines Islam as its extreme opposite. Yes.
Yeah, when you say that the West does come across as quite secular and moderate in comparison to those jihadis beheading Christians,
why do I say that?
No, wouldn't you say it was quite secular and moderate in comparison to those jihadis?
I'm talking about Voltaire. I'm talking about Montesquieu. So, first, we start with the language that we have to talk about extremes. But I'm happy to talk about jihadis in a moment. I will. We have the West, Voltaire, Montesquieu, then Weber, Islam as an extreme opposite, despotic, tradition-bound, religious, uncivilized. It is a symptom of Western power built upon empire that despite the West's unprecedented military and economic might and its unmatched deployment of violence throughout the world, it is the West that now seems the moderate against which all other kinds of violence is the extreme. I submit to you that drone attacks in civilian areas are not intrinsically less extreme than beheadings in those same locations.
Got a point of information. Just wanted to add. Sorry, I agree. But I know, but it's just to help. I would say that the French Revolution had a lot of beheadings, and the French were beheading people, including Algerians who were fighting for independence, until the 20th century. So much for only other people except the West behead people.
So let's be clear before this becomes, you know, a bloodbath in every direction. Violence undertaken by Muslims is not justified by the fact of Western domination. But the rules of the language we use to talk about violence between the West and Muslims is skewed towards normalizing the violence of Western military force and stigmatizing all other violence as extreme. All responses to Western violence in this language legitimize more Western violence and intervention. The West is responsible for Islamic extremism because it uses Islam as the extreme by which to define itself as the norm to which all should aspire, and it capitalizes upon Islamic extremism to legitimize its military and economic interventions in the world. The West is responsible for Islamic extremism also because, having intervened in Asia, the Middle East, Africa, for the purposes of economic and political gain in Europe, every European imperial power then set about weakening and then eliminating the colleges of learning, the courts, the schools, the religious centers, the judges, the scholars, and later the political parties who constituted the Muslim middle ground. If an argument is made today that Muslim societies are not making a strong enough stand against Islamic extremism, even their incapacity stems from decisions made by Western colonial officials to remove the inconvenient and resistant judges from courts, the scholars from schools, the imams from mosques, in favor of states run along Western lines by Western officials. Their continued eradication is facilitated by nationalist, secularist, and authoritarian regimes supported by Western military and economic resources, and their competition has been emboldened and strengthened by the experiences of generations of Muslims whose only reality has been poverty, displacement, and war. Multiple generations of Islamic debate, discourse, and learning, all of which support disagreement, diversity, public engagement, and accountability. Those things that, for many Muslims, continue to be at the center of Islamic orthodoxy, decimated, making it all the more possible for groups like ISIS to represent Islam as rigid, univocal, and simplistic. The West is responsible for Islamic extremism defined as an idea, because it uses Islamic extremism to define itself as the norm to which all should aspire and to morally legitimize its military and economic interventions in the world. But the West is also responsible for Islamic extremism, defined institutionally because it weakened and continues to weaken the Muslim middle ground. So we've defined Islamic extremism repeatedly, exhaustively. Let's take a moment to define the West. We may not agree on the details, but any reasonable definition would have to include this house. If contemporary privilege and its historical underwriter, Empire, had a home, it might resemble this house. I spoke to William, and then as a result of my speaking to William, he's sitting over there, so we won't talk about William. This man over here. One might, for a brief, rash moment, I don't know him, this is not personal, imagine hating this man's freedom. Is this man responsible for Islamic extremism? If we wait long enough, he will confess. But probably not. Possibly not. William, on the other hand. Islamic extremism is a phenomenon. The most opportunistic and bloody-minded of us on both sides of the line have made together. The Bushes feed the Bin Ladens feed Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda feeds the war on terror, the war on terror feeds the Islamic State. We have generally done nothing beyond accepting the Patriot Act, illegal wiretaps, secret military trials, detention without due process, extraordinary rendition, torture, drone warfare, and collective punishment. And we accept, in this atmosphere of extreme violence, that Muslims must somehow be the problem. And so it turns out that the West's use of Islamic extremism extends well within its own borders as well, and does not only affect Muslims. There is, of course, one term left in need of definition: responsible. This house has long been associated with a far different vision of responsibility than the one we've dwelt on today thus far. The debate today is largely focused on responsibility in terms of the question, this house believes the West is to blame for Islamic extremism. Historically, politically, militarily, economically, I submit to you that it is. However, responsibility understood as blame leaves some of the most privileged people in the world with the idea that they have no power to act. Almost. This house has long been a place where responsibility has meant more than a lack of plausible deniability. To be responsible means to take responsibility, to acknowledge the need and the ability to act. It doesn't require being to blame, but we cannot be responsible if we do not acknowledge that history is made, is being made, either by our own actions or by actions we allow to be done in our name. It is through acknowledging our capacity to act that we might find ways to seek credible and sustainable allies in the Muslim world, not out there, but here. It is through admitting our proclivity for silence that we admit the sure and certain knowledge that people are killing and dying in our names, as well as in the name of Islam. It is through claiming responsibility that we make sure our privilege empowers us instead of keeps us silent. Plausible deniability is not worthy of this house. Denying responsibility would diminish and endanger us all.
With the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate. What an honour for me also. My first time at the Union, despite having been an undergraduate over 25 years ago. And I will start with my personal story, because I have a slight problem with the title. we shouldn't talk about Islamic extremism because that implies that Islam is somehow linked to the monstrosities we see around the world at the moment. It should be more correctly Islamist extremism. We refer to Islamism as a over-politicized misinterpretation of Islam, which drives a lot of the rage and the conflict in the world. Now, some of that rage has some basis to it. It is partly a post-colonial and anti-colonial reaction, if you look at the roots in the 20th century. But that in no way justifies blaming the entire problem on the West, as Ash was trying to explain. Now, I was a committed Islamist for 20 years myself, so this is not just about academic debate and point scoring, it's very personal. When I was here at Cambridge, up the hill, at the great Fitzwilliam College, studying theoretical physics, I was like most young people, and I hope you are, radical. I was elected president of the Islamic Society. I rode around Cambridge for 8 of my 9 terms in a robe and a turban and a long beard. This was my way of saying, I'm not Western, I'm anti-Western, I'm a Muslim. My identity was highly politicized there. During my second year in the Christmas holidays, I traveled to Afghanistan by Pakistan and spent a couple of weeks with the Mujahideen, training in Arab training camps and even fighting in the front line against the Afghan communist forces. This was part of our jihad, as we saw it at that time. After the Soviets had withdrawn, but the jihad continued until 1992 when Kabul fell. Now, that was over 25 years ago, so I was very surprised to hear reference to just the last 25 years, because some of these issues go back way beyond that. For example, 1979, over 30 years ago, the siege of Mecca. Most people have forgotten about this, but please read the book by the Wall Street Journal journalist Yaroslav Trofimov, The Siege of Mecca. In 1979, a group of hardline Muslim extremists who were clearly ideological forerunners of Al-Qaeda and ISIS took over the holiest shrine in Islam itself, Mecca, and wanted to declare a caliphate and a pure Islamic state because Saudi Arabia was not Islamic enough for them. Despite its restriction on women and non-Muslim and everything else, they wanted something even purer. And as a result of the bloodbath and siege that followed, over 1,000 innocent pilgrims died, several hundred Saudi security forces, and most of the rebels. As I said, Al-Qaeda and ISIS go back to those people, and even before that. Now, what was happening there? Why was I an Islamist?
As I said, the Islamist movements of the 20th century, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Jamaat Islam and others, had partly an anti-colonial, post-colonial reaction. Colonialism was there in the Muslim majority world for centuries. European, Christian majority, Western powers. And of course, that was a huge trauma for the Muslim world.
The reaction to that, as people have made the point already, other people have suffered.
The Jews suffered the Holocaust, of course, in the last century. But generally, we have not had thousands of Jewish terrorists beheading Germans or other Westerners in response. The Japanese suffered
nuclear attack, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, hundreds of thousands of people incinerated in a few seconds. But the Japanese
worked hard over the decades to build the technology.
Fine,
sir. Go on.
Sorry, can you wait for the microphone?
In the 1940s and 1930s, when the beginnings of the British Mandate were formed in Palestine, the Stern Gang, which featured one of the first prime ministers of Israel, pioneered a form of bombing in which they would kill British soldiers, rip their bodies with explosives, so that when people would come to collect those bodies, it would then explode. Right? There is a history of which in which colonialism has provoked terrorism from other religions as well. And I don't think that's just like specific to Islam or Islamists.
Yeah, thank you for that. Thank you for that. I agree with the point that I alluded earlier. Every religion has terrorists. We have Hindu extremists, we have Christian extremists, Jewish extremists, even Buddhist extremists. The 969 movement in Burma at the moment is led by Buddhist monks who are Buddhist extremists, leading an almost genocide against the Rohingya Muslims in Burma, for example. But my point was general on that. People have an option. One reason why I argue against this, it implies that Muslims have no agency and no moral choices to make. As I said, the Japanese worked hard after the humiliation of the Second World War and led the world in science and technology. That has been
their way of re-establishing their power. Now, the people I was with in Afghanistan, and many of my colleagues, from Britain.
British Muslims who went to fight in Afghanistan. Many of us then later went to fight in Bosnia. I lost friend in Bosnia who died trying to defend the Muslims against what seemed like an attempt at genocide by Serb Christian Orthodox extremists again. Later, one wing of that movement became Al-Qaeda and attacked the West, or attacked America in 9/11. But it wasn't just an anti-Western raid, largely driven by the Israeli-Arab conflict and anger against America for supporting Israel. It was also a project to build a totalitarian, authoritarian caliphate or Islamic State. That was the explicit goal and has been for decades. So when we were in Afghanistan, when Kabul fell in 1992, I remember celebrating that with friends from the Cambridge University Islamic Society here in Cambridge, that Kabul has fallen to the Mujahideen. What did we expect next? In our naive and utopian idealistic worldview, Afghanistan was going to become a utopia, a pure Islamic state. It would expand and merge with Pakistan, with Iran, with Saudi Arabia, and we would have the re-establishment of the caliphate. The fact that a civil war developed for the next 4 years between the same Mujahideen leaders was one of the turning points for me, because I realized that there's a lot of hypocrisy going on here, and there was nothing to do the West. These were the Mujahideen warlords who could not sit together and settle the future of Afghanistan, but resorted to a vicious civil war, and they bombed Kabul more than the Soviets ever had done.
Point of information. I'd just like to point out, many of you have smartphones, so right now you could look up images that show some of the Mujahideen leaders that speaker's talking about in the Oval Office with President Reagan. So these Mujahideen who went on to form the Taliban Al-Qaeda, who formed all of this conflict, had very close contacts and were supported and armed by the West. And furthermore, you could even look up, you could find pictures of Osama bin Laden on the front page of mainstream newspapers, paraded as a hero by the West.
Thank you. The Civil War 1992 to 96 was the failure of the Afghan leaders themselves to do that. Now, the West has of course made many mistakes. I am a Western Muslim, I grew up in London, and I feel it's very important to avoid Islamophobia or anti-Muslim hatred, but also to avoid Westophobia, to things are not so black and white and so binary. So the West has made many mistakes. Colonialism, later supporting brutal dictators like Saddam, Gaddafi, Mubarak and others. But we have to look at the other side also. So for example, after the Second World War, the United States made a lot of overtures to the Muslim world because they saw that as an ally against communism. The book by Professor Richard Bulliet, The Case for an Islamo-Christian Civilization, brings out that issue really well. During the Bosnian War, well, as I said, at least 1,000 British Muslims went to fight in Bosnia, including many of my friends, and I wanted to join them, wasn't able to. And some of them died out there. The United States repeatedly wanted to intervene on the side of the Bosnian Muslims against the Serbs. It were the European powers who resisted that. And it was only after the Srebrenica massacre of 1995, the 20th anniversary of which is this year, when 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were slaughtered by the Serb forces, that finally the political wheels moved and we had the Dayton Agreement soon after that. And what happened to the Islamists, or anti-West, no matter what happens, and some of their allies within the West, conveniently forget all of these aspects. They forget that many Libyans welcomed intervention in Libya, because of course Benghazi was facing a massacre, an absolute bloodbath. And yes, you can't control what happens after intervention, but British Muslim Libyans, American Muslim Libyans and others firmly supported the intervention in Libya. Obviously, it's turned out terribly, but it doesn't mean that we wring our hands and blame ourselves for everything that we do. We do have to continue to try our best. I'll turn the argument around another way. For example, Turkey is accused of a genocide against the Armenians 100 years ago. People argue even that genocide made it easier for Hitler to carry out his Holocaust a few decades later. Again, we generally haven't seen major terrorist attacks from Armenians against their enemies. Many people have suffered over the last few decades and even centuries, without resorting to mindless violence that unfortunately we're seeing from Muslim terrorists who are motivated by this dream of a totalitarian state. IS and Boko Haram are good examples of that. I will close my speech by saying that we must not blame the West entirely for Muslim extremism or Islamist extremism. It is like blaming Al-Qaeda for the Breivik massacre, or blaming Islamic State for the murder of three Muslims in America recently, the Chapel Hill shootings, because that is implying that Anders Breivik and others do not have their own moral agency. And I will finish with this, is that this motion implies a reverse racism and ironically a colonial mentality, which is to say that Muslims, again, don't have their own agency and do not have the choice in terms of how they react to the suffering that every other community in the world has also suffered through its history. This is why I ask you to vote against this motion. Thank you very much.
Islamic extremism in Afghanistan. And considering it as this kind of one direct causal link is far too simplistic. It doesn't take into account the various other factors that could be considered to be part of this, such as the kind of socio-economic systems in these states in which Islamic extremism is taking place, like the kind of levels of education, like the levels of freedom of speech and of freedom of expression within these countries. And so we have to reject this notion because it's far too simplistic. It doesn't take into account all these other factors.
Regardless of which side of the house you're sitting at the moment and what you believe and which side you think is right, I want to bring your attention to a very important fact. So if, let's say, West is not responsible for the West extremism, then please do not read this as the fact that if West is not responsible, then Muslims are. I want you to get this very clearly. Even if West is not responsible or it is responsible, whichever way, it does not mean that Muslims are responsible for it, because it is the people who do these atrocious acts, they are responsible for it, point number one. And I'm just to be clear, I don't know if, probably from my name you know, I'm not a Muslim, I'm a Hindu, I come from India, I have a lot of Muslim friends, and I'm sure a lot of you also have a lot of Muslim friends, they're perfectly normal, good people. And that's what I really want to say, thank you.
Thank you. My name is Kieran Ford from Homerton College. I wanted to really break down Robin Simcox's logic and do that by answering his rhetoric of what has UNICEF ever done wrong. Now, in the 1980s, when Francis Guy was talking about the CIA funding the Mujahideen, what they were also funding was a project at the University of Nebraska, which was to design a set of textbooks to send to Afghanistan. One of the questions in this math textbook was if the Russian is standing 50 meters away and firing a gun at him, it takes 4 seconds to shoot him in the head, how fast is the bullet going into that Russian's head? It's incredibly violent textbook. Now, in 2002, in a back-to-school campaign, UNICEF, in their haste, reprinted that textbook and sent it to the schools in Afghanistan. They not only anti-Soviet extremism, but also it was a textbooks that split Sunni and Shia groups in Afghanistan. To give a second example, not in UNICEF, but in 2008, the US created this policy, the Defense, Diplomacy, and Development Approach, the 3D approach. And it basically puts the development and the sector and the soldiers working together to the aim of building schools for the point of the hearts and minds agenda. I use the both examples to express the fact that everybody, UNICEF included, is encompassed in a very, very complex web of Western violence. And I think what it shows is, with Robin's argument, and this is the point, Robin is suggesting that if you have a line of dominoes in a row, and the 10th one falls, you should blame the 9th domino and ignore the 8th falling. Thank you.
Look, maybe next week you can have this house believes UNICEF is responsible for Islamic extremism. I mean, I think. I mean, we have no idea these people in Somalia had read these Afghan textbooks. There's no possible link between the two, none we can prove. And even so, we're talking about UNICEF. If UNICEF is the biggest problem here, our reasoning has gone very skewed along the way.
We have to do a lot.
I'm just completely wrong this side, but it's sort of passing to give away the mic. Okay, opposition, what's an opposition?
Mackenzie Common, Marie Edwards College. I have a little issue with the fact that tonight we keep talking about interventions and things that we met, all as Western constructs. And yes, we all know, you know, they were founded in the West, but a lot of countries who are the sort of the Oriental, to use Edward Said's term, are big contributors to these. So for example, interventions, most people probably don't know that the two largest troop contributing countries in the world are both in Southeast Asia. It's Bangladesh and India, if I'm correct.
Southeast Asia.
So I just think it's important that even when we talk about interventions, to remember that there are other countries involved in the world who might be supporting these interventions and who should share in the blame when they go wrong, which they often do.
Sorry, they are UN peacekeepers. I was talking about aggressive interventions. Thank you.
Hi, Ruby Harrison, Sussex College. My point is for the opposition, it's not necessarily for proposition. It just seems to me to be entirely possible that we can completely blame the individuals who set off bombs and pull triggers without also accepting that it is extremely unlikely that they would have done that or believed the ideologies which caused them to do that if it weren't for successive actions of Western and other governments over many centuries. It's a little disingenuous to say that if we accept any responsibility for the West, then we say that Islamist extremists are just, you know, helplessly responding to events. I'm quite happy to blame people who kill innocent civilians and also say that had circumstances been different, had their countries not been plundered for centuries, it's unlikely they would come to believe those things. And I think this House could probably concede for a while if that was true.
Now to move on back to the main debate, we have Abdullah Al-Andalusi. Abdullah is an international speaker, thinker and intellectual activist for Islam and Muslim Affairs, and is the co-founder of the Muslim Debate Initiative. Please, a warm round of applause.
Hello, good evening. I will be your designated Islamic fundamentalist for this evening's debate. I must apologise for arriving late earlier on. I was trying to avoid Theresa May's anti-non-violent extremist dragnet around London. Today's debate is on whether terrorism committed by Muslims is caused by Western policy as a main factor, not as the only factor, but at least as a main factor, or the main factor. And the question is, and we have to look at, did all these horrendous terrorists wake up one day and say, right, let me look on the map, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, the West, we'll target you. How many terror attacks have happened in South America by Muslims targeting South American civilians who are majority non-Muslim? What about South Africa? What about Switzerland? Oh, what about Ireland? Then neutral as well. Good old Irish. So, why not them? There is, I believe it was Suriname, 17% population Muslim. There's a greater population of Muslim there percentage-wise than France and England combined, yet no Islamophobia, no tensions, no killings, shootings and violence and so on and so forth. We have to ask ourselves these questions. Why aren't they getting attacked? Now, Islam fundamentally rejects terrorism under any circumstance, under any situation, causal justification. In Islam, we believe that the rules are absolute, and you cannot breach these rules, even if you are if you think there is some benefit. But if we are trying to understand who's to blame for terrorism, we have to see the first cause, and let's go back to that first domino and see where it all started. And What will help you decide as to who is to blame is that if it's this first unjust action, and it must be an unjust action, not a good action that went wrong, but an unjust action, if this action had not happened, would we get the situation we have now in the Middle East? So let's have a look. Our opponents today seem to be claiming that terrorism happens against the West amongst Muslims themselves, would have happened anyway. They're just innocent bystanders at best, or accident-prone interlopers at worst. The overwhelming evidence shows that this is false. The Ottoman Caliphate wasn't a utopia by any means, but it did exemplify a lot of Islamic principles with dealing with non-Muslims and Muslims of different sects. The Shia shrines of Iraq were funded and maintained by a Sunni caliph. The office of the Patriarch, or the Pope, of the Eastern Orthodox Church was financed and supported by the Ottomans. Christians, Yazidis, Jews were given their own semi-autonomous regions to freely move in and out of, to administer as they saw fit, according to their culture, with their own law courts and even police forces. In West Africa, the Sokoto Caliphate and the Bornu Sultanate likewise existed relatively peacefully with Christians and pagans, or animalists. The British Empire violently conquered the Sokoto Caliphate and Bornu Sultanate, dismantling their power and building missionary schools to civilize the natives. And this developed a grudge against Western education and the newly created pro-British client state, Nigeria. The repressive state measures against a number of non-violent Islamic groups led inevitably to a rise of an increasing radicalization, which initially affected both a mixed Sufi and Salafi congregation, and this ultimately arose with Boko Haram, which itself means Western education is forbidden. So it's very specifically, it titled itself Against the West. The British and the French empires violently conquered the Ottoman Caliphate and dismantled them into arbitrary borders and much-hated client states. In 1920, Arab Sunnis, Shias and Kurds united together to rise up against the British imperial forces, and their villages were aerial bombed until they submitted. So their civilians were being bombed until they had to submit, which they had to. The British have invaded and aerial bombed Iraq 5 times in the last 100 years, not including last year. Britain and the US have entered Iraq so many times, they should probably have a reward card. The German newspaper Der Spiegel recently confirmed that ISIS was set up by former secular Ba'athist Party individuals and with a veneer of religion to give themselves legitimacy in a region where every discourse must have some religious legitimacy. And that their war on the Shias wasn't a religious war, since Iraq hasn't known a Sunni-Shia conflict for centuries, but rather they viewed the Shias as collaborators with the Americans, and they fought against them. And this, obviously, the Ba'athists were horrific individuals, but they were a secular party. The Muslim terrorists are not motivated by Islamic ideology. You've already heard the former British ambassador saying this, but let's see what the terrorists say themselves. And what the intelligence agencies say. Osama bin Laden was asked by Al Jazeera why he advocates that civilians are targeted in a war against the West. And I might add, he is CIA trained to fight against the Soviet forces. Osama said, yes, the Prophet forbade in authentic Islamic texts that to kill women and children. He forbade this. But the law's not set in stone, he says. He also says that the Quran says you should fight them as they fight you, which he says gives him license to imitate the West in military tactics. He cites Hiroshima and Churchill's bombing of German civilians in World War II as his model, not the Prophet Muhammad. He also said that terrorism was a logical response to Western occupation and propping up of pro-Western client regimes. The problem with Osama bin Laden is he's not a fundamentalist. He's a modernist who cites the West as his model of imitation. He was trained by the CIA to be an insurgent against an occupational power in Afghanistan. After that war, he realized there was just another power he had to fight, as well as the Soviets, who were also occupying Muslim lands. Yes?
I'm fascinated. When did this CIA training of Osama bin Laden take place? I've heard of the conspiracy theory, but there's no evidence at all that bin Laden had any training from the CIA.
Right, so the CIA just basically flood the Afghan Mujahideen with guns. He's portrayed as their leader, and they have no connection.
Have
right, fine.
No connection.
Anyway, Eliza Manningham Buller, former head of MI5, said, "Our involvement in Iraq, for want of a better word, radicalized a whole generation of young people and spurred some British Muslims to turn to terror." Arizona State University analyzed 2,000 extremist texts to determine what motivates the extremists. Between 1988 and 2011, it concluded that terrorists were not aiming to destroy Western civilization, but perceived themselves as fighting a defensive war. And they said, "We conclude that verses extremist cite from the Quran do not suggest an aggressive, offensive foe seeking domination and conquest of unbelievers, as is commonly assumed. Instead, they deal with themes of victimization, dishonor, and retribution." Former head of CIA Bin Laden's unit, Michael Schur, also confirmed the same. The think tank Claystone commissioned a report from Aaron Kundani, which said a decade lost rethinking radicalization and extremism, and they said this: "In this light, recent threats of terrorism inspired by Al-Qaeda are not exceptional, but fit a longer historical pattern. The new terrorism thesis tends to obscure these connections by assuming that since the 1990s, religious ideology has begun to directly cause terrorism independently of political and social context. But as terrorism scholars Joran Gunning and Richard Jackson noted, the behavior of those labeled religious terrorists is often indistinguishable from their secular counterparts." MI5's Behavioral Science Unit produced a restricted report, which wasn't intended for public release, but got leaked anyway, where they showed that far from being religious zealots, a large number of those involved in terrorism do not practice their faith regularly and are religious novices. The MI5 report said there is evidence that if Muslims are well established in religious education or practicing, they are the least likely to commit acts of terrorism. And those who are the most secular or the most, at least non-practicing, were more likely to commit acts of terrorism. Now, wait one second. It's good to see the members of the opposition continuing the time-honored tradition of depicting all the barbarian and native hordes that have ever fought against the British Empire, who do not do so because we're on their land, but no, it's because they must be a bunch of uncivilized savages who know nothing other than hate. All three members of the opposition today come from organizations connected. One second. All three members of the opposition come from organizations connected with the UK government, who tap the same ideologically motivated and politically expedient government line, allowing them a foreign policy sans consequence and domestic criticism. To point what Osama Hassan said. He said that the Quilliam Foundation have published, saying the ideology of non-violent Islamists is broadly the same as that of violent Islamists. They disagree only on tactics. Non-violent extremists provide the mood music for which the terrorists dance to. This is a logical fallacy and guilt by association. It could equally be said the opinion of disagreeing with Western foreign policy is broadly the same as violent terrorists' disagreement with foreign policy. The only difference is between the two is tactics. So congratulations, according to Quilliam's logic, any of you here who have ever criticised foreign policy, according to Quilliam, are providing the mood music by which terrorists are dancing to. But I admire the opposition. They are so strongly convicted, they won't let small things like first-hand explanations by terrorists, CIA, MI5 experts, multitudes of extremism academics, history, facts, and evidence get in the way of a good ideologically motivated prejudice. In conclusion, terrorism is conducted due to grievances felt by an identity group who feel they're being attacked, treated unjustly, or oppressed. It doesn't matter if the identity is black, white, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, Irish, socialist, female, like the suffragettes, and so on. All can be and have triggered acts of terrorism and violence in the name of identity solidarity. In the case of Islam, religious justification is no more than an afterthought used to reinforce the moral high ground amongst a conservative social context. As Osama bin Laden himself admitted, that basically there is no Islamic law or interpretation that justifies terrorism. There is only the terrorist's justification of imitation of his oppressors. Not only do they copy the West, but are the manifestation of an equal and opposite reaction to 2 centuries of unjust military and political actions by the West. So it is clear that the cause that explains extremism is not an interpretation of Islamic law, but unfortunately a manifestation of Newton's third law. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be back here. The last time I was here, over a decade ago, I was next to George Galloway. And I dare say he would be fighting on the trenches over there with the proponents of this motion tonight. But tonight, the House believes the West is responsible for Islamic extremism. Well, indeed, the West has not had a perfect policy in the Middle East, and I'm a little bit disappointed in the proponents of this motion. Little disappointed, because despite their brilliant speeches and so forth, they left so much out. I mean, nobody even started the Crusades, which is where you normally get to when you go to the Islamic world. We didn't have the drawing up of borders. I don't remember that being mentioned. All those elections. Do you remember the elections in Afghanistan, Palestine, and, of course, most recently in Egypt, that the West didn't really accept the results? I mean, the elections were a great success, to paraphrase Oscar Wilde, but the voters were a disaster. Now, there's so many things that you could have described and discussed. Those wonderful, charming prisons of Guantanamo, Bagram, and, of course, Abu Ghraib. Remember that? And indeed, you could have brought up the issue that many Al-Qaeda trainees actually watched Arnold Schwarzenegger movies to get a few tips. That might have made me an extremist too. Now, so I'm not going to disagree with many of the fine arguments that have been made about the inadequacies, the failings, the frailties of Western policy, not over just over the last 25 years, Francis, but even before. It's all true. I'll even borrow some of the arguments, if I may, for later use. I will also not argue that there's anything inherently in Islam that makes it a religion and its adherents more liable to extremism than other religions. I find that is insulting. And with respect to any conservatives here, I will not adopt the colourful Boris Johnson explanation that people become jihadis because they're not making it with girls, they're not porn-obsessed, and are severe onanists. I don't know, Mr. President, if I was allowed in this chamber or if it's ever been used before, but there we go. But is this, seriously, is this the whole story? Is this really what it's all about? A choice between an all-evil West, an evil Islam with all his extremists, or a bunch of you-know-what? Well, first of all, what is the West? Blimey. You know, we're using a Cold War concept in this debate, massively out of date. The West is divided. France objected to Iraq. Many other Western states did. Huge numbers of people living in the West in this house objected to that war. And many of the other things that are cited by the proponents of this motion as having caused or been responsible for the growth of Islamist extremism. And indeed, Christianity said from the West, but actually it came from the East. Let's not forget that Christianity and Islam and Judaism grew up side by side from the same area with many of the same traditions. Yes?
Very quickly, would your argument still hold if you replaced the word West with the words global north?
Well, I think that would take you into a lot of extra territory, but let me add to this. Take Russia. Russia is not seen as part of the West, unless you go to a nicer school where they've cancelled geography and you don't study it anymore. Now, Russia killed in two wars against the Chechens maybe 150,000 people, and many of the leading extremists within Al-Qaeda and even ISIS come from Chechnya. There are many other countries who also have to own up to their responsibility in all of these grotesque tragedies. But I must move on. So no one party, no one bloc, no one set of actors, ladies and gentlemen, should be held uniquely responsible for extremism that is seen in all different guises and places and theatres of war all across the planet. It is ridiculous. It is simplistic, as was said very eloquently over here, and it should be rejected on that. It reduces what should be a very serious debate into something almost rather infantile. To argue that fault even is just one or two countries, United States, France or Britain, also, I think, has its weaknesses. And let's not forget, in this issue of Islamic extremism, and I think this is a really important point, who are the biggest victims? Who? Is it us here living in the comfort of the West? No. The greatest victims of Al-Qaeda and ISIL aggression have been Muslims. This is a problem within the Islamic world that they have suffered for time and time again, and we get some of that spillover. So do not imagine that somehow it is just Islam against the West. That is another very warped way of viewing things. I have to make some time, sorry. And this also plays in one of the great excuses you hear across the Islamic world. It's always somebody else's fault. I hear it repeatedly. So you blame the West, or you blame Israel, or you, if you're in Saudi Arabia, you blame everything on Iran. There is always somebody else to blame. And we in the West do it too. We'd love, of course, it's very nice, convenient, to blame the other and to make the other the author of all your tragedies. I've got to move on. Thank you very much. It's an argument that says that the inhabitants of these areas have no agency or responsibility for what they do. It excuses the role of many governments in the region, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, who've had a role in Islamic extremism, Egypt. You know, you could go on. These countries have had a direct role. And also countries that aren't supported by the West. First time I saw an act of Islamic extremism was in Syria, a long time ago, actually. But it was in Hafez al-Assad, Syria. The guy was supported by Russia and was very anti-Western. Today, Bashar al-Assad, yet again, not in the West, not supported by the West, released some of the most hardline Islamists out of his jails and has been encouraging that sort of opposition. Why? Because you don't want a nice, cuddly, democratic, liberal opposition. You want a violent, extreme opposition. So the regimes in these regions have encouraged this. They played their role too. It's not just the West, ladies and gentlemen. I've got to move on. And you can't let off the Zarqawis, the Zawahiris, the Baghdadis, and all these guys. These people were not acting, ladies and gentlemen, under hypnosis. The CIA didn't have some satellite in the sky going, do as I tell you. They also, you know, they have agency. People were funding them. Those funds didn't come out of CIA coffers. They're still coming out of Zakat and so forth, various other areas. Local rulers and regimes then have their role. And I would remind you that many of the prisons in these countries, take Egypt, probably one of the intellectual godfathers of the modern Islamist movement is Said Qutb, imprisoned on Nasser, executed in 1966. A major moment in the transformation of the Islamist movement. I must move on. And there are also other non-Western actors who have a responsibility in the issue of weapon sales. Another thing that is not mentioned, yes, the West sells weapons. Surprised they didn't mention this. But the most murderous weapon in the region is the Kalashnikov. There's 100 million worldwide. The Russians are selling them left, right and centre. There are all sorts of other actors and agencies who are responsible. So let's not get into the blame game, which is region-wide. And also, too often in these sorts of debates, we look for one single reason to explain a major event. Over Iraq, it was oil. It's all about oil. Well, oil was important, but it wasn't the only reason that George Bush went into Iraq. There are many reasons. Sorry? But my point is that there are many reasons that you could argue why they went in. There weren't conflicting reasons. And there are many reasons why there is there are Islamic extremism in the Islamic world. It's not just one. There's no one party responsible. Ladies and gentlemen, we are beset by an extraordinary array of challenges. And if we shuffle blindly down a path of playing this easy game of blaming everything on the other, it's only when all the actors actually stand up to be counted and say, actually, we are responsible for our own actions. We, the regimes in the region, the non-state actors, the Western powers too, the Russians, the Chinese, who don't do very much, who actually don't try to help. Everybody has to play their role. And it's not one party who's solely responsible. And until people take ownership of these problems, we're not going to address it. So my plea is, let's try to stop, put everyone into neat, Fox News, friendly labelled boxes, divide up the world into nice, easy chunks, and pick one side or the other. It may be fun and easy, but those washed up on the shores of the Mediterranean, barrel-bombed in Syria, living under occupation, becoming refugees, will not be helped one iota. Blaming is easy. Finding solutions, ladies and gentlemen, is another matter. And this is the only thing that will end these horrors. I beg you, I urge you to reject this motion.
Thank you very much for coming.